Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Everything is fine economy-wise. The chairman of the Fed told us so yesterday, right? Well, right, except, you know, for a couple of things. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, today, November the 29th. Good as always to have you along, everybody, with the absolute awareness that even a little bit of Federal Reserve coverage can go a very long way. We are nonetheless going to dip back into the central bank's bag of tricks here as we get going. Item number one, the minutes of the Fed's most recent meeting came out this morning. That would be the meeting from just before Thanksgiving, during which we learned today there was some talk about maybe, possibly, sort of starting to think about kind of possibly not raising interest rates anymore, which is kind of what Chair Jay Powell said in that speech yesterday we told you about. So they are consistent, which is good. The thing is, Powell also said this yesterday.
These reports should be viewed as you might view the results of a regular health checkup. We all hope that a report will be like that will be not very exciting. Many baby boomers like me, however, are reaching an age where a good report is, well, there are a number of things we should keep an eye on, but all things considered, you're in good health.
The Fed chairman made it funny, right? So let's run with that analogy here, shall we? And the good health of the economy. We got the economic equivalent of a strong pulse today. Consumer spending in October, we learned this morning, had its biggest jump in 7 months. But like Chair Powell said, there are some things to keep an eye on. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams is on that one.
On top of the strong consumer spending, we also have strong consumer confidence.
That's in recent months and quarters, but we see a bit of downturn in some of those indicators now.
Matt Slaughter is dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. If consumers lose confidence, they spend less. Another risk, if the Fed misjudges where inflation is headed and raises interest rates too much or too little. Slaughter says it's tough to weigh different measures of the economy.
The challenge is to discern often, like with our health, if there's a change, knowing if that change is temporary or if it's signaling something more permanent.
Slaughter says economic surprises, just like health surprises, can also make policymaking harder. For example, the trade war with China. Not really sure how that's going to turn out. Another thing to watch, what the Fed calls historically high business debt. Diane Lim is with District Economics.
It's possible for businesses to be a little too confident and decide they can take on more debt now before there's a lot of evidence that they've reached the optimal point and they shouldn't go any further.
Leaving them on shaky ground if the economy starts to turn south. Another potential warning sign in the economy, a slowdown in the housing market. Rising interest rates are making houses less affordable, and sales of existing and new homes are down. Lim says there are demographic trends at play as well.
The baby boomers are trying to sell houses and downsize, and the millennials, our children, are not yet at the point where they're buying the houses that we're trying to sell.
While there are no red flashing lights just yet, Fed Chair Powell says he's watching. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Today, in the corporate equivalent of be careful what you wish for because you just might get it, the German industrial conglomerate Bayer, or if you want to Americanize it, Bayer. Earlier this year, as we told you at the time, Bayer bought Monsanto, the American seed and ag giant. And now, this morning, Bayer announced a big downsizing, selling off some divisions and cutting around 12,000 jobs worldwide. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains was ist los.
What pops into your head when you think about Bayer? Aspirin, right? How about
Dr. Scholl's, Coppertone?
That's Damian Conover, a healthcare analyst at Morningstar. He says Bayer also sells flea collars for dogs and cats and veterinary drugs, but not for long. Bayer didn't respond to my request for an interview, but in a press release, it says it's offloading these divisions to focus more on research and development. Conover says Bayer plans to experiment more with specific cancer drugs.
So looking at certain mutations that don't impact all of breast cancer, don't impact all of lung cancer.
Conover says Bayer got overextended. Now Bayer wants to focus on pharmaceuticals. Oh, and the agribusiness it got after buying Monsanto. Peter Pitts heads the Center for Medicine in the Public Interest, which gets some money from drug makers, but not Bayer. Pitts says Bayer's trying to be more nimble.
Their announcement today really focuses on being, you know, a lean, smart, highly creative crop science company.
There could be another reason Bayer is selling off parts of itself. It needs money to fight lawsuits from people claiming Monsanto's Roundup weed killer gave them cancer. Albert Wertheimer is a pharmacy professor at Nova Southeastern University in Florida.
I think what they're doing is trying to get a nest egg ready because there's going to be major litigation.
Wertheimer says he wouldn't be surprised if eventually Bayer splits off its crop science unit, too. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Nobody is ever going to feel sorry for Microsoft, am I right? But it does kind of seem like the company gets short shrift in today's tech conversation up against Apple and Facebook and Amazon. Lately, though, that conversation's changed a bit. From KUT in Austin, Marketplace's Andy Euler explains how Microsoft seems to have found its way back.
When's the last time you had an engaging conversation about your computer's operating system? Yeah, that's what I thought. But Microsoft probably doesn't care. The company's kind of moved past Windows.
We do treat them somewhat like a utility. Maybe the natural gas provider or the electricity provider would be a better metaphor.
Todd Bishop is co-founder of GeekWire.
Certainly Windows is still there. It's a fundamental part of the business. But if you look at Microsoft's growth, the cloud, artificial intelligence are where they are putting their bets.
When CEO Satya Nadella came in 4 years ago, he made that shift to selling cloud services to other companies, and that's really paid off. Daniel Ives at Wedbush Securities says Microsoft has also benefited from recent troubles at Apple and Facebook. Investors are shifting their money away from consumer-facing tech companies.
Microsoft is purely enterprise-focused. And right now in this market, that has kind of been the go-to that investors are looking for.
Those business-to-business operations aren't sexy, but they make money. Two-thirds of the company's revenue now comes from its cloud business and subscriptions to things like Office 365. Paul Hickey at Bespoke Investment Group.
They have this recurring, sticky revenue now, which is one of the financial traits that the market is most attracted to these days.
He says artificial intelligence is going to be the next big moneymaker for Microsoft. The company said this month it would work with Facebook to make AI software. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a little bit of profit-taking, I think, after the Jay Powell rally on Wednesday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The news of geoeconomics today, that's my counter to geopolitics, by the way, for your national security types. Anyway, the news comes from Argentina, the G20 meeting down there this coming weekend, the world's 20 leading economies, at which, as it stands now, anyway, President Trump is going to have a sit down with Chinese President Xi Jinping. There may or there may not, we don't really know, be a deal in the offing to walk back part of the trade war, but there is an historical echo of sorts in this whole thing from 30 or 40 years ago, when the Asian economy that Americans were worried about wasn't so much China, but Japan. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has the trade timeline.
American concerns about our trade relationships, and Japan specifically, started brewing in the 1970s, but really took hold in the 1980s. Japan's economy was booming. Its exports were growing rapidly. Cars, like Honda and Toyota. Semiconductors. Consumer electronics, like video recorders and Walkman. Meanwhile, in the early 80s, the U.S. was in recession, caused in part by the Federal Reserve raising interest rates to combat double-digit inflation.
A lot of blue-collar workers in manufacturing were hit hard.
Doug Irwin is a trade economist and historian at Dartmouth College.
The unemployment rate went way up, and so trade got some of the blame for that, particularly in autos.
In 1981, the Reagan administration got Japan to limit the number of cars it sold to the U.S., what's known as a voluntary export restraint. There was one for steel as well, and throughout the decade, the U.S. imposed tariffs on semiconductors and other goods it thought Japan was dumping on the U.S. market, selling at unfairly low prices. In 1984, trade was a presidential election issue.
Walter Mondale, who's the Democratic presidential nominee running against Ronald Reagan, famously said that, what are our kids going to be doing, sweeping up around Japanese computers and things like that?
President Reagan, 1986.
Our patience with unfair trade isn't endless. and we're taking action to bring other nations back in line to ensure that free trade remains fair trade.
Erwin says Japan accepted U.S. trade restrictions without retaliating because it was an ally dependent on the U.S. for military security. That doesn't mean the U.S. won, exactly. Take the example of cars. The restrictions did boost domestic auto sales and encourage some Japanese automakers to move production to the U.S. But
because Japan was restricted in how much they could sell, it sort of fostered the rise of Korea's industry. So we started importing more cars from Korea, even as we were importing fewer from Japan.
But also, despite all these efforts, the U.S. trade deficit with Japan continued to grow. Most economists don't view trade deficits as an inherent problem, but to the extent that these policies were supposed to close that gap, they just didn't.
But by the time we got to the late 1990s, the United States was much less worried about this.
Lee Brandstetter, an econ professor at Carnegie Mellon, says Americans just sort of outgrew their concerns about Japan.
In the 1980s, Americans were really worried that the United States was no longer on top anymore, right? We were no longer making the best technology. And it wounded our national pride.
Fast forward a decade.
A lot of our worry about failing to be a technological leader subsided, right? I mean, in the 1990s, it was really American companies that were inventing this new world of the internet and e-commerce. The Japanese were playing catch up.
Japan was entering its lost decade. Its bright, shiny economy faltered. Brandstetter says, as an economic competitor, it just wasn't so scary anymore.
The concerns with respect to China are, I think, a little different.
China hasn't agreed to U.S. trade demands. It's retaliated with its own trade protections. China is not a U.S. ally.
There are geopolitical reasons to be concerned about China's technological and economic rise that didn't exist with respect to Japan.
So while there are parallels between the two trade tensions, the differences make the Japan model rather unique. Brandstetter says maybe the U.S. could grow its way out of trade tensions with China like it did with Japan, but that kind of sustained growth seems unlikely. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
We started with economic warning signs up the top of the program. Well, here's another one. Bankruptcies, specifically farm bankruptcies in the upper Midwest. There's some analysis out from the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis showing that 84 farms filed for bankruptcy in its region in the 12 months ending in June, a big jump from a couple of years ago. Adam Belds is on the farm beat for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Good to have you on.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Seems like a lot, 84 bankruptcies in the upper Midwest. And as you say in this piece, bankers are worried that more are on the way. What's going on?
Well, the number has doubled in the last 4 years of bankruptcies over that 12-month period. And I think it's twofold. Corn prices have been mostly under $4 a bushel for the past 4 years. Mm-hmm. Soybean prices were already pretty low, around $10 a bushel, and then they dropped further thanks to Chinese tariffs. That's a really big deal around here because a lot of farmers in Minnesota, north and west of Minneapolis, which is where I am, they send all their soybeans to China.
We should be clear here, and you say this in the piece, that this trend in bankruptcies has been going on since 2014. It's exacerbated by the trade war. But you also point out that the Kansas City Fed is worrying about farmers in its district as well.
Yes, that's right. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of soybeans and a lot of corn in those parts of the country, too, and the prices are the same everywhere.
So now what are these farmers going to do? The ones that have filed and the ones who are sort of on the brink of bankruptcy, what happens?
Well, they get out of the business. And I would say the number of bankruptcies relative to the number of farmers, and I've gotten a lot of emails pointing this out in the last few days, mm-hmm. is still very small.
Yep.
You know, it's way less than 1% of farms in this region have gone bankrupt. But I think it's useful to think of bankruptcy as the tip of the iceberg of farm financial troubles. So I think what's going on more than bankruptcy is farmers going to their bankers now that they've completed the harvest, they're looking at their finances, they know the full picture, they go to their banker and they need to get a line of credit for next year.
Hmm.
And that's going to be a really telling time because you talk to farmers and you talk to bankers in the rural upper Midwest and they say that there are going to be a lot of farmers who just choose not to do it, you know?
Yeah.
They would have to sell. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, no, I was just going to say, we've got a corn farmer we talked to in South Dakota, and when I was there, and this was, you know, 3, 4, 5 years ago, whatever, I went up into his combine that was sitting in the barn or garage. Well, I guess it's a barn on a farm. But that thing costs like $400,000, and the guy's got to make payments, and he's got cash flow issues and the whole deal.
Right. And what I'm hearing is a lot of farmers are going to have to sell equipment, tractors or combines or land to satisfy the banker that they'll be able to make their payments. And you can only sell so many tractors before you don't have any tractors left, and then you're not a farmer anymore.
Yeah.
You know?
Last thing, and then I'll let you go, Adam. The president, as you know, is down in Argentina for the G20. One of the meetings we thought he was going to have, but now maybe not, I don't know, is with Chinese President Xi Jinping. How closely are farmers and folks that you talk to there watching this meeting for signs of progress on this trade war?
Pretty closely. I talked to a farmer in southwest Minnesota yesterday about this, and that meeting has always been sort of looked ahead to as a chance for progress, like you mentioned. There's, I think, less optimism about that now. The way Vice President Pence has been talking about the trade negotiations, the guy I was talking to yesterday said, you know, that's just not a way to negotiate, to come out with a list of demands ahead of time. And so I think the outlook is not great, and people are following it closely.
Adam Bells, he covers agriculture for the Star Tribune up in Minneapolis. Adam, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Coming up,
flavor enhancers for cocktails would probably be the number one item we sell online.
Pay online, pick up in a store, pour yourself a drink. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 27 points today, about a 10%, 25,338. The NASDAQ, 18 points on the downside, 0.25%, 72.73. The S&P 500 off 5 points, about 0.2%. 27.37 there. Philip Morris' parent company, Altria, is in talks to take a minority stake in the e-cig maker Juul Labs. The Wall Street Journal had that story. Altria up 1.8%. Teen clothing retailer Abercrombie & Fitch surged more than 20% today after posting stronger-than-expected earnings growth. Guess rose 2.4% today on sales and earnings growth as well. The medical lab operator Quest Diagnostics shed 9.2% today after it cut its annual profit and revenue forecast. The company also cited reduced testing volume, among other things. I will tell you, though, full disclosure, they're sticking some needles in me tomorrow. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.03%. You're listening to Marketplace. Listeners like you who give to Marketplace do more than just keep us on the air. You make it possible for us to grow and get better. It's a way to directly support independent reporting and journalism that you trust and to help us make people smarter about the economy and how it affects our lives. And when you give today, the impact of your gift will be doubled thanks to our friends at Candida. So please donate now at marketplace.org to make your donation go twice as far. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Until not too long ago, a year ago or so, one of the biggest American export categories to China was our recycling. Chinese plants used to take about 40% of all of our recyclable paper and plastics, used to being the key phrase there. And that change, that the Chinese now take very little of our reusable waste, has hit the people who run recycling companies here in the United States. Today's installment of our series, My Economy, How People Are Making a Go of It in Their Economic Day-to-Day, comes to us straight from the floor of an American recycling company in Brooksville, Florida.
My name is Greg Conaty, and I'm in the recycling business. I grew up in business with my father. I started with him when I was 15, and then when I turned 16 and got my driver's license, I was their first employee, and I started actually driving the truck and doing the routes myself. We do mostly paper, cardboard from commercial businesses, and we also do containers for mixed paper recycling. I believe we are one of the few left that is a private, family-owned business in this type of business. price for our cardboard has actually come down quite a bit from what it was in 2017. And prior to that, the mills that are here in the country are just overfull. We're increasing service charges, trying to reduce employees as much as we can, and just trying to save money at any possible way that we can save money, and just hope that fuel prices don't start to rise, because we go through quite a bit of fuel here with our trucks. I haven't seen the markets this bad. I've been in this business a long time. We've had bumps in the road in the early 90s and the crash that happened in 2008, but nothing has lasted this long. In my head, I'm a big advocate of environmental issues. As far as having the time to go out and do those types of things, it's very difficult. I work a lot of hours, and with the employment situation being the way it is, we're always shorthanded on employees. I'm working 6 days a week. It's just not a lot of time to do the things I would like to be able to do as an advocate, but maybe one day when this all settles down, and I'd like to be able to do those types of things.
The way this works is we can only do these stories if you send them to us. There is a place you can do that, and please do. It's at marketplace.org. You may or may not know this, but all that free two-day just-in-time-for-the-holidays shipping that a whole lot of us are banking on, the value add that's pretty much stock in trade for the biggies like Amazon and Walmart, yeah, it ain't so free, as small businesses know all too well. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
There's a hot sauce shop in Houston called Iburn. It's owned by James Beck.
And my title is Hot Sauce Boss.
Beck has a storefront with all sorts of colorful hot sauce bottles, which he sells online too. In fact, 40% of his roughly $500,000 in annual sales comes from online orders. And lately, he says people are starting to expect that their hot sauce bottles ship for free.
I actually was on the phone with someone, and they wanted me to ship them one bottle of hot sauce, and they were upset that they had to pay for shipping.
He says, look, it's a $5 bottle of hot sauce. I'd lose money on this if I covered the shipping. The customer says, fine, I'll go to Amazon.
They've got tens of thousands of people that can get that thing packed up and shipped out almost instantaneously, and have the volume to be able to minimize the costs to offer you free shipping. And we've got Doug.
Doug, the warehouse manager, and James, the hot sauce boss, are also up against other small businesses that are making shipping cheaper to lure customers. Take Etsy, the online market for crafty stuff. Kruti Patel Goyal at Etsy says in the last quarter, less than 20% of items on Etsy ship for free.
That percentage is increasing over time, and we expect that to continue to increase as our sellers adapt their shipping strategy to buyer expectations.
Buyer expectations that stuff should ship for free and also quickly. The consulting firm Shipware recently did a survey of shippers who said fast delivery is the biggest pressure they're facing. Keith Myers at Shipware says smaller retailers feel that the most.
I've heard from multiple places that they have been eating the express shipping charges, so a two-day air shipment. They'll charge some of it to their customers, but not all of it.
To speed up delivery, Myers says some companies have been using their physical stores as mini distribution centers instead of relying on warehouses in the middle of the country.
That way the transit time can be a little bit quicker because you're not fulfilling out of a centralized location, you're fulfilling out of a store that's close by.
Another way for retailers to cut down on shipping costs, making customers pick up their orders in the store. Natasha Amott owns a cooking supply store called Whisk with three locations in New York City.
So in-store, we do a very nice business with cleaning products, and then we're trying to push it more online.
The website, she says, works well for other types of goods, like specialty items.
One of our hottest items are bitters. Bitters are flavor enhancers for cocktails. That, in fact, would probably be the number one item we sell online.
Amott says about a quarter of her online sales are picked up in-store, which helps drive in foot traffic and saves everyone money on shipping. Still, small businesses face competition even on in-store pickups. Walmart and Amazon have pickup lockers in stores across the country. And Target recently announced plans to make curbside delivery available at over 1,000 locations. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which we may well have reached peak capitalism. Starting this weekend, just in time for the holidays, you can buy for $39.99 one of those big mouth Billy Basses. Remember those? You can buy one that connects to your Amazon Echo. Yes, somebody did hack one back in 2016.
Billy Bass.
Yes.
Tell me a joke.
But this apparently is the official version now. Why? I don't know. All right, that's it. We're out of here. Dow Industrial's down 27 points today, a 10%. NASDAQ off 18, about a 0.25%. The S&P 500 declined 5 points, about 0.2%. Amir Bibawe, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Stephen Gregory, John Gordon, Karen McKella, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.